This is Faster, a podcast by Flow Cycling. In each episode, we interview industry experts to educate you, challenge you, and even change the way you train so you become faster.
Hey, this is John Thornham over at Faster. I just finished recording a podcast with Matt Chase. Long story short, we actually went to school together back in the day in UNB in Canada, both mechanical engineers, and Matt is a vibration expert. He's been working in the vibration field for almost 20 years, and he actually helped me several years ago when we started doing a lot of vibration studies at Flow. This is a really cool podcast. We talk about vibration, what it is, how it works. If you are technically minded, you're probably going to like this one. If not, hang on. There's some pretty cool stuff that comes in later on how it impacts the body, the rider. We talk about vibration from the road, natural frequencies, and then we get into something called vortex shedding, which is kind of interesting. I didn't really think too much about this, but Matt brought it up. Learn everything you can here about vibration, how it impacts the body, and how you can use this information to help make you a faster athlete. Everyone stay safe, and we'll talk to you soon.
When we're not creating this podcast, we're working on other ways to make you faster. At Flow, we design and manufacture some of the world's fastest cycling wheels that we sell consumer direct to keep more money in your pockets. As a special thank you for listening to Faster, we wanted to offer you 20% off your next purchase. Simply use coupon code PODCAST in all capital letters at checkout. Your purchase will also support our give back initiatives. 1% of all sales supports our Bike for a Kid program, where we provide bikes and helmets for kids in need. We also plant one tree for every wheel we ship as a thank you to our planet. Enjoy the show.
Matt Chase, welcome to Faster. How you doing?
What's up, John? How are you, sir?
Doing pretty good. Doing pretty good. Matt is, it's a long story for those listening. Matt and I actually went to school together like 20 years ago in New Brunswick in mechanical engineering, studied mechanical engineering together. And a little while ago, I was doing some vibration work on wheels, and Matt has been a vibration expert as an independent consultant here for like 20 years. So he's like the guru of all vibration. Why I haven't had him on the podcast yet, I don't know. But I think it's going to be a pretty cool conversation. If anybody that listens to this knows that I am a mechanical engineer, and Matt is as well, and Flow has really been like an engineering based company. So we do get into like some pretty detailed conversations at times. This one will be somewhat technical, but we're going to try and make it fun and talk about how vibration it impacts the bike, and then it impacts the cyclist and a whole number of things. But we want to cover vibration first. But before we get into that, Matt, tell us a little bit about yourself, about what the work that you do, and then also about yourself as a mountain biker. Because if anyone's ever seen Matt ride a mountain bike, it'll scare the pants off you. Because I tell you, there's certain things he rides over on his bike I wouldn't be comfortable in like a full all-terrain vehicle. He's a serious mountain biker.
I happen to be very good at crashing too.
So I've seen a few.
yes, that's right. No, yeah, my background, I'm a mechanical engineer. Graduated college in 05, 06 timeframe, and I've been working with heavy industry. So heavy industry means mines, pulp and paper facilities, oil and gas facilities, heavy industry like that, doing vibration diagnostics and vibration mitigation/correction on those pieces of equipment for about 18 years now. So I've seen a lot of different pieces of equipment, a lot of different problems, helped solve a lot of these problems. Now, I guess you probably want to know why vibration is a problem. Well, vibration typically, when a piece of equipment is having a problem, it'll manifest itself sometimes with vibration. And you can look at a vibration spectrum and figure out what the issue is with that. And with that data, you can come up with a plan for correction. So that's kind of the, long end of the thing here. So
cool.
Is that pretty clear, Joe?
Yeah, 100% clear. And what about mountain biking? Tell them about your mountain biking background. You were a motocrosser. So you kind of came to this with, a pretty solid background.
Yeah, I started riding dirt bikes in the 90s when I was, in like junior high and going into high school, and started riding and both riding and crashing them as well. So yeah, that's where I kind of got my start. And then as I got older, I said, wow, I think I need to do something that keeps me a little fitter than letting dirt bikes carry me around. Now, riding dirt bikes is very physical. There's no question about that. But I wanted something that was a little bit more cardio intensive and maybe a little slower. because of the crashes. I had several crashes that put me in the hospital for an extended period and ended up being kind of costly and, you know, kind of scary. So, yeah. You know, if you can keep the speeds down on a mountain bike when you crash, it's, yeah, there's possibility of getting hurt, but, you know, there's a little difference between 30 miles an hour and 65 miles an hour. So I think the danger goes up exponentially. So for getting into riding bikes, I like to, I'm not a road cyclist. I like to climb, do a lot of big climbs and big descents on mountain bikes. I like to go to bike parks and hit jumps and drops and all that fun stuff. So that's my interest.
Sweet. Awesome. All right, let's get into some vibration stuff. I think first and foremost, let's just talk about vibration. How would you define vibration in like its simplest form?
Yeah, I guess there's a couple ways you can kind of look at it. You know, you've got free vibration. So if you think about hitting a tuning fork. Now a tuning fork is going to resonate at one of its natural frequencies. So, you know, as you input energy into something, the particles inside of that thing will vibrate at a particular frequency just naturally. So a tuning fork is designed to vibrate at, say, 500 hertz or something like that. Really, however it's designed, it'll respond in that way. So,
and I think for people listening, hertz is like cycles per second. So if you hear like one hertz, that would be like, you know, you think of like your hand waving, that would be like one wave per second. 500 yeah. hertz would be like 500 waves in 1 second. So just exactly. to clarify that. Yeah.
Yes. No, very, very good. Yes. So that's the free vibration component of it. Now you have force vibration as well. So if that's inputting energy into a system at a particular frequency. So you think of the tuning fork. If you hit a 500 hertz tuning fork with a 500 hertz input, you're going to get resonance at 500 hertz. So that can amplify vibration up, you know, anywhere from 5x to 100x. So I guess as an example, if you've got an opera singer, you know, an opera singer, she or he, the frequency that they produce can be very, very high. Now, if you have a wine glass, which is a very, very stiff thing, now the wine glass is going to have a natural frequency of whatever number. And if the opera singer, she sings at a frequency that matches the natural frequency of the wine glass, well, the wine glass is going to shatter. So that's kind of like the basic description of resonance. So those particles, they're inside that wine glass, vibrate naturally at 1,000 hertz. And if the opera singer can produce a frequency at 1,000 hertz, well, that's going to excite the natural frequency of the wine glass and cause it to crack and shatter and break. So it's kind of cool to watch. Now,
cool. And resonance, right? So when you say when it hits resonance, that means like it's hitting its natural frequency, right?
Correct. Yeah. It's
the
input frequency matches the resonant frequency, which is of the structure. Yes.
Okay.
So how we look at that in industry, we work a lot with variable speed electric motors that drive large equipment. So just think of just for a, you know, easy example, there's a 1,000 horsepower electric motor driving two large rollers, and there's material that's squished between the rollers, something like that. So for process purposes, they need to keep production at a certain level. So they run the electric motor from 30 hertz to, say, 50 hertz. That's the range that the motor runs at. So vibration can come about on the equipment if you've got unbalance of the rotor or misalignment of the rotor, or if bearing problems show up, you're going to get elevated vibration levels. And those elevated vibration levels typically occur at a frequency that can be seen in the vibration spectrum. So most of these pieces of equipment are mounted on structures that with a particular amount of stiffness. Now, you know, sometimes they're on concrete bases, or sometimes they're on steel bases. It really just depends on the original design. So the problems that we've run into, it probably through my career, I would say around 70% of the issues I have run into are resonance problems, as we talked about kind of earlier from a 1,000-foot view. So what that means is that the natural frequency of the components of the equipment, whether it be the rollers themselves or the base or the structure that the equipment is mounted on is resonant at a particular frequency. Now, if the turning speed of the motor or a multiple of the turning speed of the motor matches the natural frequency of one of those components or the structure, you end up with resonance, which results in significantly higher vibration amplitudes. And now those amplitudes, you know, there's several different things that can occur, right? You can fatigue the component and it could just break, or the bearings, if it's a rotating element or piece of equipment, fail earlier because they're experiencing larger loads. You can also, and typically when these things fail, they fail at in the middle of the night on Christmas Eve when nobody's really in the plant. There's just a minimal amount of people. So it can be very, very costly. Now, if you are able to identify these vibration problems beforehand and take the equipment out of service and make the either swap the piece of equipment out or modify the piece of equipment so it's not operating in resonance, then you can save your client a significant amount of money. So those are the types of problems we've run into, like, you know, very large induced draft fans at power plants. You know, they're running 24/7, and you know, sometimes they have material running through the fan that wears the blades down, and the fan becomes unbalanced, and then the fan excites the natural frequency of the structure that it's in, and all of a sudden the whole building that the fan is mounted in is shaken apart. And so our clients will come to us and say, hey, what, well, we've got a problem here. We can't quite figure out what's going on. So we can instrument the equipment with accelerometers and, you know, 32 or 128. You know, we can do a lot of accelerometers and then match that up with impact data that we required on the unit when the unit is not in operation. And you can find areas where resonance occurs. And from there, you can have a plan to either change the speed at which the resonance occurs, or you can stiffen the structure to shift the natural frequency out of range of excitation. So that's kind of the in industry how everything works.
Well, that's pretty cool. I mean, I've seen this done. We actually did it on some wheels. You came out probably like 4 years ago now. I think it was during COVID, right around that time. And what I think is really interesting is there's this thing called like a modal impact hammer. So you put an accelerometer, we put accelerometers on the wheels, and then you tap the wheel with this hammer. And what it does is once you tap it, the wheel will vibrate at what its natural frequency is. And then you can pick that up with the accelerometer. And so we use that because we really wanted to understand when we were riding on the road, and we'll talk about this more in a bit, like, were we exciting natural frequencies and how could we manage that through tire pressure? But also, like, in industry, what I think is really neat is, like, I just want to summarize because I'm following you, and I just want to make sure that everyone else here is following as well. Basically, you've got like a roll, and then you've got like an arm that's holding that roll, and you've gone out, and same thing with the wheel, you've tap tested that and you hit it with the modal hammer. You are getting what the natural frequency of that is. And then is that roller is spinning. If it hits that same same frequency, then you're getting this really crazy increased vibration amplification of like 10 to 50 times, like you were talking about earlier.
Yep.
That's right, right? I got that straight.
That's correct. Yeah, absolutely.
Perfect. Okay. So I remember when I first learned about natural frequency, I was really trying to come up with an example that for me made sense. There's a really cool video. If you've never heard about this at all, it's called the Tacoma Bridge or Tacoma Narrows Bridge. It's a bridge that was designed years ago, and the natural frequency of the bridge was matching basically the airflow of the wind blowing across the bridge, and it excited this bridge. And you just have to watch the video. It's like a ocean wave, and then eventually this bridge collapses. And so we learned about that. And the way I've always kind of thought about natural frequency in my head is, if you've ever been on a trampoline, if you are bouncing on the trampoline and you are bouncing properly, you just keep getting more height out of the trampoline. And you can actually have people who will assist with what's called bounce. And so they'll like push. And so it's sort of like that amplification because you're in sync with the movement of the trampoline. However, if you're there and somebody is on a trampoline and they jump at the right time before you hit the trampoline, it throws the trampoline off and you lose all of your bounce, right? So that's kind of outside of what I would consider the natural frequency, which I think is kind of interesting. It's kind of fascinating how this stuff works and how much it can amplify. So getting back to what we did with wheels, one thing I want to talk about is in industry, you're talking about how we have these motors that are spinning at a periodic, like a known frequency. Mm-hmm. We have like 7 hertz or whatever.
Yep.
One thing that we learned about the road is something called random response or random frequency. Can you talk about that a little bit and what it means from the road perspective and why it becomes random versus something that's periodic or okay. cyclical?
Yeah, absolutely. If I get off track, John, just please.
Yeah, sure.
So that's like a random vibration or broadband vibration. The way you kind of think of it is that you're going to get input energy over a large frequency range. So, you know, you're going to have it happens with wind. It happens with flow of liquids. They cause this very broad input and energy into the system. So that's kind of as the wheel rolls down the road. I mean, apart from the turning, if you're at a constant speed, you have an input from the turning speed of the wheel, but then you've also got the input from the wheel as it passes over the uneven ground, which kind of doesn't occur at any particular frequency. Typically, it kind of occurs at a broad range of frequencies because you got all types of excitation there. So does that make sense?
Yeah, it does. And I think I think the broadness from the road, I mean, we always talk about like, we've talked a lot about on this podcast about like rolling resistance and certain things like that. And I think what most people assume is that when you're on the road, that the road is smooth or perfectly flat, and it's not. When you look at rolling resistance tests, traditionally they're done on like steel rollers, or if you're in like an indoor track, a lot of guys there will use like 200 plus PSI. And ideally what they're trying to do is they're trying to minimize the size of the contact patch, because when a tire sits on a road surface, you get a flat spot on the bottom of that tire. And so the smaller that is, the less of what's something called a hysteresis effect. If you think about a tire on the ground really quickly, as you are rolling the tire forward, there's compression on the front of that tire and the back half of that tire is expanding. It's rebounding to take the original shape of that tire. And so what you get is you get the energy being absorbed in the front is greater than the energy that's being released at the back. And so you have a lost energy over there. It's called the hysteresis effect. So when you have a super, super high tire pressure on a steel roller or a track, what you get is a very, very small contact patch and you lose less energy, your rolling resistance drops. The minute that we go out to the pavement, while we think pavement is smooth, it's not. And so when your contact patch gets really, really small, what starts happening is you start to actually bounce up and down. You skip, right? So you're thinking about putting watts into the pedals. You want those watts to move you forward. And now we're wasting energy because we're bouncing up and down over the road. When that starts to happen, it's something called the impedance breakpoint. And we want to have our tire pressure down below that. So one thing that we started to look at and tried to measure, and this is some of the work that we were doing with Matt, was can we get the understand the natural frequency of the wheel, in which we did. We found that. We measured it over different weights, different tire pressures, different wheels, different sizes. And then we would take those wheels and we would go out and we ran a series of tests. And we used accelerometers on the wheels and we were gathering data in X, Y, and Z to try and understand, did we see an increase in energy? And so when you're looking at acceleration data, basically what you're looking at is you're looking at the amount of energy that's moving in X, Y, and Z. You can measure it in like G forces. And so if you do a summation of those G forces over a certain tire pressure, you can see the total energy that's being put into the system from a vibration perspective. And what we were able to basically prove was that once you hit the impedance breakpoint, we increase the energy so much because of the vibration and the bouncing that we could basically find an impedance breakpoint by monitoring the acceleration data that we were picking up from the road. However, the natural frequency was very important because you get this broad range. I think we looked what 0 to 1,000 hertz, Matt, wasn't it on the road?
Yeah, I believe so. Yep.
And so we noticed that most of the natural frequencies of cycling wheels are range anywhere between about 60 to 100 hertz, depending on the shape and the model of the wheel. But as we hit that impedance breakpoint, the amount of energy being introduced into the system as a whole, especially in that lower range, just increased greatly. So I think it was really fascinating. And when you looked at the data, Matt, you saw the same thing, right? You're noticing that, and you actually picked up some of the stuff on the turning speed as well, right?
Yeah, you can see if you're running at the same turning speed, the analyzer is going to pick that up. So you say you're riding at 10 miles per hour, you're going to have a impulse at 10 miles per hour, then you're going to have the input put from the road that, that John was just talking about. Now, the natural frequency of the tires, too, can change given the their stiffness or how much damping that they have from a, I guess, from a fundamental
standpoint. The layup of the tire, right? I mean, you could have like different materials, yeah.
That's right, yeah. From like a fundamental standpoint, that a natural frequency is defined by the square root of the stiffness divided by the mass. So if you increase the stiffness of something, the natural frequency is going to increase. And if you add damping or mass, because the mass is on the denominator of that calculation, you're going to reduce the natural frequency. So that's something that you can change with, that would change with tire layup and all that stuff. So,
yeah. And one thing that I think was really interesting, and it just blew my mind when I first, I didn't understand it. When you explain like the turning speed, we did two tests. So we ran the tires and different tire pressures on rollers. Like we had a set of like Kreitler rollers, which are super smooth. And the response was really weird. And it was almost like this, it was the turning speed. So let's say that this kind of confused me, and I'm going to have you explain this, but let's say like the natural frequency is like at 7 Hertz. Well, how does the multiplier effect work for like 2 times turning speed, 4 times and that? Cause you get excitement in the different, at the different turning speeds as well, right?
Yeah. So typically the most energy occurs at the 1 times turning speed of the wheel. But if you look at it in a FFT vibration spectrum, you're going to see also multiples of that turning speed. So you'll see like a 1 times, a 2 times with lower input energy, a 3 times and maybe a 4 times. So if something is really loose, you're going to see very high amplitude, 1 times, 2 times, 3 times, 4 times multiples. Now, if you have something tight, typically like the bearings on a very expensive road bike, you're going to just see the high 1 times. But does that answer the question, John?
Yeah, definitely.
What you're looking for. Yeah.
So what? Yeah, yeah. So if we, let's talk about what vibration can do in a system as well. So let's say that there's a few things. Number one, I want to talk about from like a component perspective. So we have bearings in a bicycle wheel. You do a lot of like industrial size bearings.
Yep.
If we have the natural frequency of the wheel is being excited because our tire pressure is too high and we're starting to put vibration into the system, which makes its way through the hub, eventually into the frame. What is actually happening to the bearing when we have increased vibration due to exciting the natural frequency of the wheel?
For sure. So there's in bearings, there's a load zone. So the load zone is the spot that is taking all of the force. So that force is transferred from, I guess, the hub to the outer race of the bearings. From the axle to the inner race of the bearings to the ball bearings themselves to the outer race to the hub. So if the load is really high, you can end up with very small indentations typically occurs in the inner or outer races. So if those forces are really high, then you know, as you move along more and more cycles, you're going to end up with kind of fatigue failure of the material inside the bearing, and you'll end up with what's called a spall. So as the bearing ball bearings pass by this spall, it gets worse with every rotation. And then you end up with clearances in the bearing opening up, and then the bearing just basically fails and all the balls fall out and there's catastrophic failure and you're not riding anywhere. But
you're not riding anywhere. Yeah, that's no fun. Is there a performance impact on a bearing if it's riding during vibration? So I think about letting a bearing run where there's no vibration, it's smooth, good operation. Now, if I were to basically vibrate that bearing, so it's spinning, but there's vibration as it's spinning, does that impact the efficiency of the bearing while it's spinning?
100%. Yeah. And and a lot of the older electric motors that we see in industry are, I guess, considered low efficiency motors. So maybe in the last 20 years, they've had high efficiency motors that have bearings that are designed to operate with better resistance to vibration. So you get a lot less energy required to operate the motor, and having very good tight tolerance bearings are key, I guess, in that reduction of energy use.
That's really interesting because I've always known that there's a reduction of, you're losing watts basically by bouncing up and down. There's stuff that happens in the body, which we'll talk about in a minute, but I never to know that you're impacting the performance of your bearings. A lot of guys will go out and buy ceramic bearings and they have these like really high efficiency bearings. But then if you're putting vibration through the bearing, you're basically shooting the efficiency of the bearing. So what's the point of putting the good bearings in, you know? That makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So let's say that the other thing I want to talk about is the impact on the human body. I know there's some like OSHA studies, and I know there's not a ton in cycling. There is some, we've talked a lot about it on the show, where we talk about like micro tears in the body and like fatigue and stuff like that in the hands. What do you know about the impact of vibration on a body over time?
Yeah. So I guess I'm just going to talk with my experience, which is in industry, and then maybe move into the cycling portion. But, you know, if you have an operator of a piece of equipment that is basically standing on shift, say he works a 12-hour shift 4 days a week, and he's standing on a piece of equipment that is in operation for that amount of time. Now, there are certain thresholds that can actually cause issues with the body. And there's been documented issues of not just like carpal tunnel stuff, but like actual vascular blood flow related problems from standing in one location while a piece of equipment is vibrating. So now, with the ergonomics pushed for better ergonomics to, you know, keep people at their desks or at the machine for longer for production reasons, and obviously to keep the person safe, you know, they try to design around that stuff. So the problem is that a lot of the industry has just really, really old equipment that hasn't really been updated. So you can, you really need to be cautious about that, because it can definitely affect your body. Now, from a cycling standpoint, I notice it most in, just from, this is anecdotal, I guess, but I notice it most in my hands from doing a large ride. You get a lot of vibration transfer into your hands, which end up not just from gripping the bars, but just fatigue from that vibration over time. And you end up with your hand kind of locked in one position. I did the whole enchilada in Moab, Utah back in October, which is they drop you off at the top of the La Salle mountain range and you ride down to back into the town of Moab. It's about 35 miles and the terrain it's pretty harsh. But I mean, it's like typical mountain bike terrain, but it's very variable. So there's a lot of high speed because it's all downhill mostly. There's some climbing, but mostly downhill. There's a lot of high speed that results in a lot of vibration in your hands. So And that's not necessarily components being excited, I don't think. I don't think the bars are necessarily being excited by any means. It's more just that broadband vibration that's transferring into your hands that I notice.
Yeah, cool. I think one thing that's really interesting to point about when you talk about wheels and reducing vibration as well, we've had a lot of questions over the years. We used to make an aluminum rim wheel and then we moved to a carbon fiber wheel. And I think the first thing that you notice when you get to a carbon wheel is that there's a different feel to it. It feels smoother. Mm-hmm. And I think what's important to point out is that wheels and materials absorb vibration differently. So carbon wheels are better at absorbing higher frequency vibrations, and aluminum as a material is better at absorbing lower frequency vibrations. So just for the sake of this, we'll say that anything 100 hertz and below is a low frequency, and 100 hertz and above is high frequency. So you may think that most of the stuff, like I just said, natural frequencies happen generally 100 and below. But there is stuff that happens when you get this random response on the road that happens above. So most people initially think that, well, an aluminum wheel would be better because it handles lower vibration better. However, what you can do with a carbon fiber rim is you can create a sidewall structure that creates a leaf spring. So if you take a carbon wheel and you section it in half, the spokes connect at the bottom, the tire connects at the top, and you have these sidewalls, these thin sidewalls that create almost like a membrane, like a leaf spring on a vehicle. And so when you ride over that, if you design the layup of that wheel properly, the vibration that transfers from the road hits those sidewalls and it's basically absorbed. And that's where you can absorb a lot of the low frequency stuff with carbon fiber through that sidewall. So you actually get the benefit of both. You're getting the benefit of reduction in vibration from low frequency through the layup design. So you get the leaf spring effect. And then the material itself absorbs a lot of the high frequency stuff. So that's, I just think that's kind of cool. I kind of want to point that out. Very cool from a reduction perspective. So that's why when most people go out on the road and they feel that, that's one of the first things they feel. Another thing that we always talk about is the reduction of tire pressure, which we've been talking about a lot. And you'll notice it specifically in mountain biking. I mean, if your tire pressure is too high and you're going around a corner on some gravel or sand, you're going to go down pretty quick. So when we lower that tire pressure, we're reducing the vibration movement up and down. You get better grip and better traction. You would agree with that, right, Matt?
Yeah, 100%. There's kind of like a benefit point there where the pressure is either too low, because if you hit a corner too hard, your tire will start to roll over and it'll just kind of feel spongy underneath you. It'll grip, but you're just not able to rail that corner quite as hard as you want to. But yeah, once the pressures kind of get up, especially riding in Las Vegas or in the West, where you have a lot of loose rock over hard surface.
Moon surface, yeah.
Yeah, you get the moon surface there. So yeah. loose over hard, it can get kind of squirrely there pretty quick. But back to your point about the carbon fiber versus aluminum wheels. Like what I've noticed with those is there's a lot more, I guess, as you mentioned, John, like damping in the carbon wheels. So it feels like a little less connected to the ground, which can be fine. It's just, and it fatigues. I found it fatigues my hands less, if that makes sense on carbon 100%. For sure. It just feels a little less connected to the terrain, which can be fine. But yeah.
You know, it's funny. I recently, I have a little boy, he's three. He rides his bike all the time. He's got this little Strider bike, and I have been walking with him on the bike because trying to manage him has been challenging. But just this week, I built up this bike that I have in the garage, and for fun, I put on a set of our 650B gravel wheels with these big 47 mil tires.
Nice.
And when I first set them up, I set them up tubeless. And generally when I set up tubeless, I like to keep them at high pressure for like 24 hours to basically make sure everything sets in. And so my first ride, he was all excited. I was setting them up, showing him how to set up the tubeless stuff. And I went out and I rode these 47Cs at like 55 PSI, which is like way too high. I mean, super high. And so I was riding around the roads. I mean, I felt everything through the bike. And so what I've been doing is I've been taking them on these rides. I've been like really experimenting with like dropping pressure. And if I look at like our tire pressure charts for that, for like pavement, I'm probably being like the low to mid 30s, but I've just been experimenting and I just keep dropping pressure on these tires. And right now I'm riding at like 20 PSI in these wheels, and it's, I don't know, man, there's like this cool feel with it. You just kind of absorb everything. The grip is just like phenomenal, and riding around with him, it's been interesting. So I've got this fun bike I'm experimenting with, which is really fun. Yep. Let's talk about something else from a vibration perspective, which you brought up to me, which I didn't really think about. And it's about like fluid flow, like aerodynamics. And as we're riding and we get vibration around the body based on like vortex shedding. I mean, we look at aerodynamics a lot, and our goal from a wheel design perspective is to basically lower the drag. And that's done through basically the way we design the rims. But I've never thought about it around the body. So talk about that and how that impacts the rider.
Yeah. So as you mentioned, John, about the vortex shedding. So as a fluid passes around an object, whether it be stationary or moving, as the, John, you may want to correct me. I know you're a fluids guy and I'm less of a fluids guy, but I have dealt with the vibration portion of this in my career. As the vortex sheds, it creates a force perpendicular to the direction of travel of the fluid flow. So think of a bike moving down the road, going through the wind. As the wind passes by you, it sheds, makes a little vortice, and then the vortice bumps against the side of your body. So what can be interesting from what I've noticed from an industry standpoint is that those vortices can excite those natural frequencies that we were talking about before and increase vibration significantly. So that would depend. So the frequency of the vortex shedding changes with wind speed. So if you're going 30 miles per hour, it's going to be a particular frequency. And if you're going 15 miles an hour, it'd be a particular frequency. So where we've seen this in industry, I worked on some very large power poles, and they were ended up cracking and falling over and a whole bunch of stuff. So what we found is the natural frequency of the power poles matched the vortex shedding frequency at a particular wind speed. So if the wind speed was going to be, you know, 45 miles per hour on one day, they were like, oh, we're going to have problems. So from that point, we had to do a little bit of design of the poles to modify them. But
that's interesting. You know, you think about riding a bike, everything's based on relative velocity, right? So a lot of people think that your ground speed is what impacts your aerodynamics, but it's really the relative velocity. So if you're riding down the road 10 miles an hour from a ground speed perspective, but you have a 5 mile an hour headwind, you're actually seeing 15 miles an hour of wind.
Right.
Or if you're riding in, you know, at 10 miles an hour, you have a 5 mile an hour tailwind, you subtract it. So you're really seeing 5 miles an hour. But I've never thought about exciting the natural frequency of a wheel or a bike or a system based on vortex shedding. That's interesting. So really you could be introducing vibration into the system, even if you have the right tire pressure.
Yep.
Oh man, we're gonna have to look at that. That's pretty cool.
yeah, it's super cool.
That's pretty fascinating. And it goes right back to laminar flow, right? So, I mean, ideally, when you are designing something from a wheel perspective, you want good laminar flow around the, especially on the front half of the wheel, and there's the back half, because the minute that you get into turbulent flow, you are creating this vortex shedding and all this other stuff that creates a lot of negative. Mm-hmm. So yeah, very interesting. Man, I never really thought of it that way.
Yeah,
I like it. Anything else that you can tell us about vibration that we haven't talked about or that you would think is worthwhile mentioning?
No, I mean, from a cycling standpoint, I don't know. I think we pretty much covered it.
Nailed it. All right, man. Yeah. Well, this is awesome. You wouldn't know this, but this is Matt's first podcast, man. So I think he absolutely knocked it out of the park here. Nailed it. Cool stuff.
I talk to clients a lot, so maybe that was I'm kind of the same old spiel, I think. So
yeah. So listen, Matt is an independent consultant. So if anybody needs him for any reasons, just reach out to me, John, Flo. You guys know how to get me, and I can put you in touch with him if you want to do any vibration work. I mean, he's pretty cool stuff. So that's awesome, Matt. I'm sure you'll be out riding sometime soon. And definitely appreciate you being on here.
Thanks, John. Appreciate you having me.
All right, man. Ride safe.
Thanks for listening to Faster. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it. Leave a review or teach a friend what you learned today. For more great episodes on getting faster, subscribe to this podcast. While you're on your next ride, be kind to one another and ride safe.